And our special guest tonight, Richard Dolan, as we talk about UFOs and the national security state. This is volume two. Up next, we'll talk with him about a couple of these top cases that he has looked at right here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, if you had to pick some of your top cases, what would they be?
Well, that's really hard because it's such a dense period of sightings. But I would say if I had like a top three or four or five, probably at or near top place would be a very famous case among researchers, and that's the 1976 case of UFO over the city of Tehran in Iran, in which that an unknown, very bright object had an attempted intercept made by two Iranian F-4 fighter jets in succession. That's an extraordinary case, partly because of the nature of the object itself. It was stationary, but was able to detach a smaller object, which actually went on an intercept of one of the jets. In both cases, those jets had all their instrumentation disabled, their key instrumentation disabled at a range of 25 miles. We've got a lot big write-up on that by the Defense Intelligence Agency. We've got a very good document on it. We've got satellite confirmation of a UFO over that spot as well, due to Defense Satellite Program information, DSP satellites. That's a heck of a case. And the fact is, the Tehran case of September 76 just does not have a reasonable explanation in any conventional terms. You got the Rendlesham Forest case in 1980, which I think is, of course, everyone who looks at UFOs knows about this case as well. Rightly so. It's a very, very strong case. In my book, I tried to put together what I think is really the most concise but complete description of that case to date. I spent about 10 pages really trying to analyze all the complexities of that case. That was a tough one to unravel only because there was a lot of – the Rendlesham case is one of these instances where we learned about it over the years through drips and drabs. It didn't come out all at once.
And a little like Roswell, too.
Right, like Roswell in many ways. In the case with Rendlesham, just getting the dates right was a problem, finding out was it two nights or three nights, what exactly was going on. This was not easy. But I really feel that I did as good a job as I could in trying to make sense out of that. That's an amazing case because what we have is an object that lands or hovers either in a forest between two American air bases in Britain. And we got a lot of people on the record about it. We've got a document by the deputy base commander confirming it and a lot more. So it's a fascinating case. I would also mention one that's a little less well-known, at least to Americans, and that's the series of sightings over middle of nowhere in the nation of Norway over an area called Hessdalen in the early 1980s. And to me, Hessdalen is fascinating because it doesn't fit any known kind of phenomenon. What people were seeing there, I mean, there is no one living out. In Hessdalen, you could be in this valley and hear a tractor like 2 miles away.
Yeah, it's one of those.
Absolutely.
The sounds of silence, right?
Precisely. And yet people were seeing these lights that were maneuvering and stopping and then going again. And they wondered, is this some kind of natural earth phenomenon, ball lightning of some sort? But it seemed to be intelligent. And not all of the sightings were of simple light. A lot of them were were tracked on radar, because what happened is a lot of researchers from the local university came out with their own equipment, and they would camp out in the freezing cold weather and just track this. What you had, in other words, was a group of very dedicated researchers, and the fact is that the Hessdalen phenomenon continues to this day. There are people who are out there right now with camcorders, and they are tracking some very unusual things. I've seen some of this very recent footage. It's fascinating. But it was an amazing case in the 1980s, and I don't pretend that I know the answer to what happened at what's been going on there, George, but that's bizarre stuff. And the only thing that I could say definitively is, where the hell are the scientists here? You know, the actual academic scientists.
Oh, you would think they'd be running all over the place.
One would think. And this is a phenomenon, they could go there today, and they'd be in a very good opportunity to catch something unusual. I mean, for most Americans, yes, Norway's remote, I understand, but there's Europeans, they can get out there, it's not that hard, right?
Then we have this strange spiral, which Hoagland will talk about tomorrow.
Well, that's interesting indeed. I myself am very curious as to what this is. I don't have a conclusion on this at all. But I'm very interested in following that. Back in the olden times, known as the 1980s, I would say there's maybe two or three other cases that I would rate as very, very high level. Another one, this is fairly well known, the famous Hudson Valley wave of sightings, not far from where I'm living in New York State, in the lower portion of New York State and into Connecticut. There were some just incredible sightings of objects that went for several years, thousands of witnesses, large. I don't believe that that these were light aircraft flying in formation, as was sometimes argued, and I try to make this case in my book. One that's less well known is an amazing encounter over the state of Alaska in 1986 by a commercial airliner actually transporting cargo. Late at night, in the middle of the night, going up almost over the North Pole and down to Alaska. For about a half hour, this airliner, the pilot, and his crew noticed objects flying with them. In one case, detaching two smaller objects that were in front of the cockpit, shining a bright light into the cockpit, he said. This was tracked by multiple radars, military radars, including. It's a great case. That pilot was relieved of his flying duties for a while after he made this report. Nice incentive for other pilots to report bizarre things.
To tell you what they see. Yeah, exactly.
And maybe with the last one that I might include is one of the tops. And, you know, people can quibble over these. You can pick five others if you wish because there's a lot to choose from. But maybe Mexico in 1991. Mexico, of course, famously through the 1990s, had some very, very, and into our own time, has had some very interesting sightings.
And great pictures, too, Richard.
Well, exactly. And the reason, I think, in July of 91, they really kicked off with a lot of very good video. This was the beginning of the UFO career, basically, of Jaime Musan, who was doing television work down there. What happened is, in July of 91, a lot of people were out for the solar eclipse, and this is a very big deal. So what they were filming from different parts of the country, it was this object that looked very metallic. So some people argued, well, it was just an effect of the eclipse, but I don't think so. I've seen the video myself. There's been some, a lot of people have studied this, and I personally consider it very interesting and difficult to explain. And of course, later, and what I'll have to cover in my third volume of this study, is the phenomenal sightings that took place in Mexico over that the entire 1990s.
In front of thousands of witnesses.
Just so much video. Extraordinary to watch. And gets, again, you know, very little attention, really, north of the border.
These cases, I mean, what are the possibilities that some of them are military, our own?
I ask myself this frequently. One thing that I tried to do in my book, in fact, George, was to keep track of the current state of research, state-of-the-art research that was going on in various technologies in aviation, for example, and technology computing and so on, and really ask myself, how likely is it? I guess I would have two answers to this. My personal opinion is that it is highly probable, I would say almost certain, that some of the UFOs people have been seeing during this period are indeed man-made, part of some deep black project, some covert government spending project that we don't know about. The problem that I have is that when you look at the known state of technology. So, for example, one thing I looked into is the development of quiet helicopters during the 1970s, asking myself, were helicopters quiet enough that they could be silent in the mid-70s to account for some of these? Or looking at developments in stealth and other capabilities of aircraft. To be perfectly honest with you, I just am not seeing a lot of evidence that the state-of-the-art technology that is known to us can really account for a lot of these. But what I do believe, and what I've started to argue, is that there are much more advanced stages that have been attained, even, you know, in the covert world. I can't prove this. It's very difficult to prove these because we're not in a situation where we can just walk into Groom Lake, for example, and see what they got there. But I am of the opinion that there have been significant breakthroughs in technological development that have been made. And I argue toward the end of my book that this has been a substantial element of the UFO reality, that the covert world has sort of broken through, and they've almost moved into another phase of civilization.
That's what you call the breakaway civilization, right?
That's the phrase that I've used for it, yeah. And I've been thinking about this more and more over the last couple of years, and my theory or reasoning about it is essentially as follows. If you go back to the 1940s, and let's for the sake of argument, that the U.S. military recovered some exotic piece of technology, whether in the form of a craft or some other part of a craft.
Right.
So now we've got this thing to study. Now, let's pretend that you're Harry Truman and you've got this awesome decision to make. You know, do you want to tell the world that this kind of this reality is here?
And we've got it, you know.
But you might have an instinct where you want to think, you know what? This is America, darn it. I want to tell the people the truth. But then you might think twice about it. A, there is a little thing called the Cold War going on at the time. And if you were to tell the world that you've got this exotic technology, well, it might be a lot harder not to share it with other people, including the Soviet Union, for instance. Mm-hmm. So now I think what you might want to do is you'd gather your top people around you and you'd say, let's figure this out. You know, one guy's job will be to get this to private industry, maybe. Another job will be to look at the sociological implications of this and find out how bad the panic would be, and so on. But what I think happens eventually during the 1950s and 60s is that this did get passed off to private industry. It makes the most sense, frankly. The military is not in the position to do the R&D and the replication of this, but Boeing, Lockheed, General Electric, General Dynamics, Raytheon.
Bell Labs.
Absolutely, Bell Labs. They are in the best position to study this. They've got the guys, they got the engineers and the R&D people. And so what I believe happened is that at a certain point in all of this, and I don't know when, the lawyers got involved, and some level of ownership, however we define this, of that technology transferred its way to the private sector. Look, this is not an unusual thing to state. If you look at all other aspects of the U.S. government, we see the same trends. We see privatization getting its hooks into what is supposed to be publicly controlled institutions. And I think the exact same thing happened with the UFO secret. And so now it's not just a classified problem. It's something that's proprietary. And I think that also improves the secrecy, frankly. But eventually, so let's take this little story a little further. Now it's the 1950s or 60s, and some of our scientists make some breakthroughs with their understanding of this technology. I think it's entirely feasible that they wouldn't necessarily share this with the world. They might use that breakthrough to for only classified purposes.
Right.
Now, the way science goes, of course, is that it's often exponential. One breakthrough leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another.
Or maybe they'd hold it back until they thought they had to use it.
Exactly, and we have our own history of holding back our leading-edge classified technology public. The stealth fighter was not used in the raid on Libya in 1986, even though we had it. And the reason that we didn't use it was because its existence was considered too sensitive to deploy for that mission. So we had the perverse situation where you got this raid on Gaddafi, and it failed. Actually, they didn't kill him. Whereas they might have succeeded had they used the F-117, but they didn't.
Killed one of his wives and kids, unfortunately.
Well, that's right.
Of him.
The point being that we have a history of holding back the top technologies from public use. I really believe that
it did shut him up, though, Richard, I think.
Well,
yeah.
Well, let's not call it a failure from that point of view. But
exactly.
My point simply is that the top fighter of that period was not used because its existence was still classified. And so I believe that this same type of logic holds probably with breakthroughs in UFO technology. And then the problem is that the farther along the classified world gets, the farther ahead they get, it just might be that the harder it is for them to relate and bring the rest of us up to speed. And so secrecy sort of, becomes even more difficult.
What I find fascinating with your work and the work of some others, something's going on out there. I mean, you know, one can take the posture, okay, this is not happening at all. There, people are seeing, military-built craft, and that's just it. But there's just too much of it worldwide, Richard.
Well, if it is, then one has to ask, why is it that military jets are chasing these things all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
It most famously, just a couple of years ago, the Stephenville, Texas case. A couple of years before that, we had the 2002 event right outside the nation's capital, right near Washington, D.C., where a couple of F-16s.
And the 97 Phoenix case is still huge, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that's a significant case. Yeah. It's complex because I think there's different elements to the Phoenix case. But yes, I agree that that's a very significant case. So to call it all black technology and secret, if it is, then the only conclusion I can make is that there's a rogue, a truly rogue element of human civilization that's got this stuff that's beyond the control of the formal U.S. military. That's a pretty scary thought, too. Maybe that's the answer, but whatever the answer is, let's get down to the bottom line here and make it clear that, as you just said, there is something going on that is important, that is not getting an adequate explanation by the powers that be. Whether we want to argue about aliens or black technology, as I look at it, that's almost a secondary issue, frankly. Let's get to first base first, which is a recognition of the reality that this is a phenomenon that is involving somebody's technology, and they are doing something that is important to them, because I have to assume that this is involving a substantial amount of somebody's infrastructure.
Yeah.
These things are being seen everywhere. They're being seen in the atmosphere. They're being detected in the oceans, and they are being seen all over the place. So someone's got something. It's as if I spent my whole life studying history and thinking, for most of that, my young adulthood, that I was ahead of the curve until I really started to dive into this topic, and then I realized how little I knew. It occurred to me that there is a very large part of my history, of my nation's world history, that was not fitting into what the conventional stories had. And so the question that has occurred to me is, well, what's the true history? What's the true history of the Kennedy administration or the Nixon administration if we factor in the UFO reality? Presumably there's got to be something.
Well, then you have to add in alien abductions, these animal mutilations, crop formations, all these other pieces that are, puzzle pieces to this big picture.
Absolutely. And what it looks like is there's this enormous, enormous reality that is off our official radar. And it's a mind-blowing thing to think about. I still struggle with this, but I've been doing this 15, 16 years, and it's still something that I shake my head at times thinking, this is astonishing. You turn on the TV and watch the news, what passes as news there, and this stuff is completely absent. And yet it certainly looks like this is a massive part of our reality that is just being blocked off. And then people, they say, well, Dolan writes about conspiracies. Well, this is why. I mean, I ask myself, where is this stuff on the mainstream news?
It's not there. You recently wrote about 12 documents. I want to talk with you about that, too, when we come back, that prove that the U.S. government has interest in these UFOs. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Richard Dolan on Coast to Coast AM. Oh, we'll take your phone calls next hour with Richard Dolan. When we come back, we'll talk more about UFOs and the national security state on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, you wrote a fascinating article titled 12 Documents That Prove the U.S. Government's Interest in UFOs. What are the documents?
Yeah, they're actually, I put them on my website, complete with the JPEGs, which you can enlarge and read them, and my own commentary on each of them. What my purpose was simply to start at ground zero, so to speak. And if there's a skeptical person or just an interested fence sitter who wants to know what's all the fuss about, why does a guy like myself look at the government involvement in UFOs? Well, this is a pretty good place to start. These are various U.S. military documents and intelligence documents that go from the 1940s through the 1990s that we know of, that describe events, dealing with UFOs that are, again, like I was saying earlier, not necessarily proof that all UFOs are alien, but certainly proof that these are serious matter. The first one that I have listed is, again, for research, is a well-known one, the 1947 memo by General Nathan Twining of Air Material Command. Twining later became chief of staff of the Air Force. At this point, he had three stars on his lapel, and he was answering a question from another general, essentially, who had asked him in late summer 1947, are these flying saucers anything we need to deal with? And Twining essentially wrote back and said, yes, as a matter of fact. In other words, we're not making them. He described in great detail the nature of the military reports that describe these. The most interesting ones is that the objects, he said, were generally silent, had a metallic or light reflecting surface, left no trail, were circular or elliptical in shape. And then the best part was that they were often flat on the bottom, domed on the top.
Yeah.
In 1947, let's get real here, what could look like that? He didn't say in this memo that these were alien craft invading the Earth, but again, they are interesting. There's an FBI memo from 1949 sent to J. Edgar Hoover it's fascinating, really.
And these are authenticated, right? These documents?
Oh, they are. They are not disputed documents. These all came out of U.S. National Archives frequently during the glory era of the Freedom of Information Act in the late 70s. And people can just go through them. My website is keyholepublishing.com. I've got the documents there. Anyone can read them. Intelligence reports through the 1950s. One of them is a CIA memo. It went to the director, Walter Beadle Smith, by his director of scientific intelligence. And the statement here, and this is just a couple of sentences. I would love to read this. This is in December 1952. H. Marshall Chadwell, the director of scientific intelligence, is writing to the director of the CIA, and he's saying, at this time, the reports of incidents convince us that there is something going on that must have immediate attention. He goes on and says, sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. Now, that's a big mouthful there. Keep in mind, this is a bureaucratic document. It's not like he's going to say, boss, I think we're being invaded. But how much closer do you want? This is a very important statement made in 1952, and there's many, many others. I have one here from 1966 describing an intrusion at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. That's fascinating. Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, 1967, in which a large glowing something was above nuclear missiles and shut a whole bunch of them offline, appeared to shut them offline. A lot of people are familiar with Air Force officer Robert Salas in connection with that case, and Robert has spoken at length. We have documents describing that.
And these are incredible cases.
They're awesome. A couple from the mid-70s. I mentioned the 1975 overfly, so I got one dealing with that. The amazing encounter over Tehran that we spoke about earlier. Got the Defense Intelligence Agency documents here for people to read. Incredible. The Halt memo, this is the Rendlesham case from Colonel Charles Halt describing that. Very interesting. People should know. Here's one that's very little known that I think is one of the best cases. I almost should have mentioned it earlier. A 1988 case involving the U.S. Coast Guard right near at the shore of Lake Erie in March of 1988, right near the town of Eastland, Ohio. We have the Coast Guard document that describes it. We also have a great deal of independent witness testimony. Very strong case. What happened is that this object was over the frozen part of Lake Erie, hovered low over it and cracked the ice, apparently due to the heat that it was emitting, sent out a bunch of, described by witnesses anyway, smaller objects that did all kinds of zipping around the skies. Fascinating case, and we have a Coast Guard document. After that, the Coast Guard and other government agencies issued a dismissal of the case as astronomical. I think it was Jupiter, they said.
That was Jupiter, cracked ice, right?
Lame. As my kids would say, that's lame, man. And then the last one that I include is the UFOs over Belgium in 1989-1990. This is a series of U.S. Defense Department documents that describe those events. What we had there is what appeared to be a perfectly triangular craft, or multiple of these crafts, I believe, that people had seen, lots of witnesses. These objects doing things, again, that ordinary aircraft just can't do in terms of the slow speeds, the rapid acceleration, changes in altitude very rapidly, and so forth. Belgian Royal Air Force tried to intercept on one occasion, one night, with two F-16s, and they just utterly failed. And we've got this documentation here. So, you know, none of them by themselves, as I keep emphasizing, prove that these are aliens. But again, what I would suggest is that any reasonable mind, when looking at these cases, has to be asking, what does this mean? Why are the militaries of the world chasing these objects if there's nothing to them? This doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
And with the chase, to me, it sounds like they are concerned about them. You don't chase things you're not concerned about, Richard.
Yes, excellent point. I think that's very true. And so my conclusion is that there's some kind of trouble in paradise here that we're not being told about. And this is one of the elements, incidentally, when people talk about disclosure, or sometimes people use the phrase exopolitics, I try to remind people that if we're going to have a true study of exopolitics, that is presumably the relation of us and them, whoever them happened to be, the part of the things that have to be taken into account here is that we have some kind of confrontation going on that has been continuing at some level for over 60 years. And so that's an important element of this relationship, is this continual confrontation. Now, I'm not saying who are the good guys and who are the bad guys here. I don't know enough to say. But I do think that this is not simply a case, okay, where we can just open our arms here and welcome these other beings, whoever they are, without a very careful inspection of who and what they are.
What do you think is going on, Richard? What's your gut tell you?
Here's my gut, all right? This is just me speaking as a person who has studied this, but my feeling is that we human beings and this planet, Earth, are both of supreme interest to other intelligences that have somehow found a way to observe us and to be here. I mean, look, not only do we have a really phenomenal planet, we've got water, we've got all of this
life. We've got everything. We've got
genetic diversity. Oh, right. Minerals. This is a great place. And I have to assume that other life forms would be aware of just how great this place is. But the other thing is humanity itself. There are a lot of researchers in this field, and I think they disparage us really more than is warranted. I hear people say things like, well, why would aliens be interested in humanity? We're a bunch of comparative savages. We can't get along. We may destroy ourselves. Well, here's why they would be interested in us. Look at the trajectory that our species has gone on in the last century, just 100 years. 100 years ago, we had a society of horses pulling carts.
Yeah.
Now we get cars, and we get planes, and we get airplanes, I mentioned. We get bombs.
Now we're joining them in space.
Exactly. My kids have iPods, and nano iPods, that have like thousands of songs on And they can do things that I struggle to keep up. The technology is amazing. In 10, 20 years from now, we're going to be moving to what people call quantum computing and advanced nanotech and advanced artificial intelligence. So in other words, in the blink of a cosmic eye, we have essentially reinvented ourselves as a civilization and probably as a species, because we have to assume that we're going with greater changes in biotechnology as well. And who knows what we're going to do to ourselves.
Well, and look at how long it has taken some of these other countries to get to where we were at 60 years ago, for example, in terms of technology. They're just, many of them, they're just now getting to where we were 60 years ago in terms of coming up with the atomic bomb, coming up with ability to send
but
out
their,
satellites.
Their rate is much faster than ours.
But it is dramatically faster. But exactly. That's just 60 years.
Yeah.
You know, if there happened to be a civilization 5 million years advanced from us, assuming that knowledge universally is growing at the same rate, they're way ahead of us, Richard.
Probably, but here's how I might look at it. You know how, in the study of an atom, you've got valences, you've got little orbits, right? So electrons will jump from one to another.
Right.
What if it's a similar situation with knowledge and with civilizations? In other words, what if we don't just have a gradual change, but we make a jump? In other words, so with the development of, say, quantum computing plus strong AI plus nanotech, what if that combination allows us to make not just a little bit of a jump, but a big jump?
Yeah.
Such a jump that it might allow us in some manner to, as it were, leap into their world, maybe not as equals, but maybe as an issue, as a problem. So that what I'm suggesting, George, is simply that other intelligences are probably looking at us and knowing that we are about to leap into their world. And if I were one of them, I would be watching humanity with some interest.
Well, absolutely. Especially with the warring part of us. You know, maybe they are too. I don't know.
Right.
You know, I happen to think the universe is the same. As I was talking to Seth Shostak from SETI a long time ago, that there's this primordial soup, which is everywhere. It abounds throughout the universe. So I would guess that their civilizations have had the same kind of problems that we have faced.
Well, right. Not knowing any different, I think that's a reasonable thing to assume. I think it's safer to assume some level of universality in a general term. Life is composed, as far as we know, of the same types of elements and right, so it might develop in similar ways.
Do you ever see a red ant drop itself into a black ant colony? I mean, it's a war.
Ouch.
It's a war. So, I mean, even from the little tiny insect stage, this planet is a fighting planet.
Right. Well, my feeling is that why should it be different elsewhere?
Yeah, it probably isn't.
I have frustrations with some of the fallacies that some of my colleagues in this field have in their attitude toward presumed extraterrestrial intelligences. And one of the biggest fallacies that I feel is out there is that if they're so advanced, then they must have solved their social and technological problems, or they wouldn't have gotten to that level. And I just feel that this is utterly illogical. It would be like if we went back in time 3,000 years to some ancient human society with all of our technology and all of our cool stuff. And they were to look at us and think, wow, iPods.
Yeah.
You must have solved all of your social, political.
Or they'd say,
economic.
Why'd you come up with that iPad?
Yeah, right.
It's too big.
Yeah, right. Fascinating. I'd like to try it out. But the thing is, I believe it's a fallacy to assume that with greater technological achievement, we therefore should expect these other beings to solve their problems. I don't see.
Well, and the other thing is, if we add in spirituality into the equation, you have to assume, well, maybe they have now reached this point where they're so loving and benevolent, but maybe not. Exactly. Because I think that we will always have greed and corruption. not only on this planet, but all over the place.
Well, why would any life form not look out for number one in some manner? In our own history, we have had many societies, it's true, where people do not have a strong emphasis on individuality. A lot of traditional tribal communities are known for this feature. So there is a wide potentiality of human nature in that regard. I would certainly leave it open that there's a wide potentiality with non-human intelligent species as well. However, I think to ignore the likelihood that other species are essentially trying to survive on their terms, I think that that's a fool's path. And what any kind of post-disclosure world, if we ever get an actual disclosure, which is a we'd have to watch out for the truthfulness of that, in my opinion. But if we get to the level where it's acknowledged that there are other beings that are here, we're going to have to look at them with a critical eye, hopefully not a panicky eye, but certainly we need to keep our heads and really look at this as critically as we can.
I want to talk with you next hour, Richard, about underwater possibilities and tunnels and things. You've been doing some work with Dr. Richard Sutter. As a matter of fact, you're also publishing some of his work, right?
I am indeed. I'm publishing his latest book called Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files. It's a fascinating book. I absolutely love this book. And it's wonderfully illustrated as well and very well argued. Richard's been a friend of mine for a number of years. He's one of the most remarkable people I know. And I'm very proud to be publishing his book. It's the first book by another author that I've published. I'm getting my feet wet into this.
Well, good for you. Now, what about the TV show? What's going on there?
Well, it's interesting. 3 years ago, I did a brief TV show for the Sci-Fi Channel called Sci-Fi Investigates, and mm-hmm. that was fun. It's TV. You know, every time I do any kind of TV thing, I get people who write and support it and say, oh, great job, and other people say it's the most horrible thing. Why do you do television? You can't please everybody.
No, you can't.
But we're working on a new show now. It's called First Contact, and I'm working with a great producer, a really great guy named John Doria, based out of the Philadelphia area, not too far from me. I'm up here in Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
We've got a great crew of additional people who are with me. I'm the lead investigator. It's a kind of UFO show where we're going to be looking into cases.
A different twist, you know, like Bill Burns and UFO Hunter, but a little different.
So yeah, I think it's a similar kind of idea, certainly. Yeah. I really believe, and I'm not trying to knock any other shows that have been out here before because they've all have their own merit, but I certainly am going to strive for our show to be the best of its kind. I absolutely believe that. I'm working very closely with John on selecting the cases that we will have for the show. And I just want to add that the other three individuals who will be on camera with me will be Mike Lukowiak, whose nickname is Lucky, Jamie Winden, who's a professional photographer. Mike, by the way, does great. He's a ghost hunter. Got a lot of the equipment that the guys on Ghost Hunter have. And Rob Simone, who's in the UFO field and is very well known to UFO researchers, people involved. And that's how it's going to be.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the underground tunnels and these bases, and get another update on this TV show. Tell us if this pops when it could be, and then we'll take phone calls with you as well. Richard Dolan, our guest on Coast to Coast AM.